cables, do we really have to go here? This is where the angry people turn up.
I know.
Do it.
I know.
Do it. Yeah. All right. Do it. Otherwise, you're just denying the importance of cables.
Hello and welcome to the Evie Forums Hi-Fi podcast for the 6th of May, 2024, if you didn't know the year. And on this edition, we have our Evie Forums Hi-Fi editor, Ed Selly. Good afternoon, Ed.
Hello, sir.
And new to the podcast, but not new to Evie Forums Hi-Fi reviewer and sound advice editor, Simon Lucas. Good afternoon, Simon.
I feel you're right.
Very good. Thank you for joining us, guys. We're going to talk Hi-Fi this afternoon. Specifically, we're going to talk about Munich High End, what we're looking forward to, what we expect to see at the show, and why the show is important in the world of hi-fi. And then we're going to move on to our 2024 subject, which is building a hi-fi. And this month, we're talking about stand mount and bookshelf speakers, what you should be looking for, basically everything you need to know about those. We'll give you our opinions and experiences with those products, so which will hopefully help you in your hi-fi buying. And also, if you want to watch the video version of this, just remember it is on the AV Forums podcast channel, not the main YouTube channel, but you can watch the video version there. And of course, if you subscribe to that channel, you'll get every single podcast that we release. And that's one every Monday going forward, even when there's five Mondays in the month. We thought of that. We're doing a games podcast, and you've just had our first ever games podcast on the channel. So give us your feedback on that as well. Who are AV Forums? Well, if you're new to the podcast, new AV Forums, we're one of the largest AV and hi-fi communities on the internet. We started in 2000, the editorial side in 2003, and for my sins, I've been here the whole time. And we create content for you, the end user. We don't have any influence from manufacturers or advertisers. We give you honest, unbiased, and experienced opinions and knowledge. And if you don't know who I am, I'm Phil Hinton. I'm the editor of the site, have been for the last 20 years. ISFTU checks, PVA trained and certified, been reviewing TVs and audio gear for longer than I care to remember. And also on the podcast, we've got Ed. So Ed, why don't you quickly introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Ed Selly. I'm the Hi-Fi editor for AV Forums. I work for basically anybody if they cross my palm with silver, but I've been working for AV Forums for an extremely long time now. Not as long as Phil, but I did my first stuff for them in 2012. So well over a decade, and I've been a forum member for over 20 years, which is alarming when I stop and think about it for any length of time. I have done AV in the past, and I can still from now and again be found covering little bits of it in the background, but predominantly two channel these days, reflecting the fact that two channel is back alive and well and kicking. And I produce a fairly significant amount of content on a given month for AV Forums, and then obviously my name will crop up on other things as well depending on where you look.
Okay, excellent. Ed, and Simon is new to the podcast. So Simon, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about you.
Well, I haven't got anything like the hours that you two have put in at AV Forums, but that's a lot of that was because I worked at Watt Hi-Fi for a long time. I was the editor there for a good while. But for the last 5 years or so, I've been freelancing, and much like Ed, I will freelance for anyone who will take me. And so I've been involved with AB Forums for the last few years as well. And at the start of this year, I became the editor of Sound Advice Online. So what I deal with is mostly two channel. I do get involved with video stuff as well, but I will obviously defer to you every time with that, Phil.
Excellent. So that's the team this afternoon. Hopefully we've got enough experience amongst the three of us to tell you all about speakers and so on. And that's what we're going to talk about. But before we get to that, we do have a current competition. Ed, do you want to tell us what that is?
Yeah, just let me fire it up. Right. We have got... where is it gone? You can win a Project T2 Superphono turntable worth £559, courtesy of Peter Tyson and Henley Audio. It's the perfect deck if you're looking to step up from a starter turntable, and comes with a Sumiko Rainier cartridge, glass platter, and the option of three colorways: gloss black, satin white, or walnut. The competition closes at 11:59 p.m. on Sunday, the 2nd of June. All competitions are open to eligible AV Forums members over 18 who are residents of the UK. So head on to over head on over to avforums.com/competitions to enter. There's also a range of DVDs, Blu-rays and 4K discs available for patrons and standard AVF members to win. Disc competitions are also open to eligible AV Forums members or patrons resident in the UK. And we've got some previous winners as well. Greggles won a set of KEF LSX2 LT wireless speakers worth £899. RGB123 won a pair of brand new Q-Acoustics M40 speakers worth £749, courtesy Rocking of Peter price. Tyson. Yeah, that's some decent prizes being given out there. Last but by no means least, we've got some new patrons in the form of Arthur Yarwood and Jeff. I like the fact that Jeff is all capitalised. I like the emphasis there, Jeff. That's good going. And additionally, we have been bought a coffee by Matt Evans, Mr. Black 79, Repo Man 666, and beer bottles. So thank you very much to all of you for your ongoing support.
Yeah, some fantastic prizes. Well done to the winners. And yeah, thank you for your support. It really is appreciated. One day we may even produce a good podcast for you. One day, maybe. Right, so let's move on. We need to do Q&A feedback from the last podcast, which was, no joke, the April the 1st edition of the Hi-Fi podcast, and we covered turntables. We had quite a bit of interest in that subject. It is a subject that some of us know from years gone by, and some of us are just getting into the hobby. So some questions. We picked a couple out. So Ian 52G says, as mentioned, he's the winner of the TIC DAC amp. I'd just like to say a big thank you to AV Forums and TIC for running the competition and supplying the unit. You're more than welcome. I've not had much of a chance to fully test it out, but early impressions are good using a USB from a PC and Bluetooth streaming, easily driving a set of B&W 705 signatures cleanly. Well, there you go. Sounds like you've got an excellent system there, Ian. And Toon Army, he said, finally finished and an excellent podcast that seemed to cover everything. The new format really works well in these situations, allowing the subject matter to be discussed extensively. Thanks. I never sold my vinyl collection, which I started back in the mid-70s, and many of my records come with memories attached. Well, well done, Toon Army, for hanging on to your vinyl. Mm. I sold all mine in the early 90s and regret it. I also sold a Mint Technics 1210 Mark II, and I've never been able to replace it. So, yeah.
Well done. Act in haste, repent at leisure.
Yeah, I know. I know. Right, so let's move on to the subjects today. It's a show I've never been to, Munich High End. It happens next week, is that right? It opens on the 9th of May, I believe.
Yes, this at the time of recording, this time next week, I'll be confused and amongst many, many thousands of other hi-fi people, and it will be alarming.
Drinking beer and eating
no. There's far too much to do, unfortunately. So,
but you're not going to have a beer.
Not during the show, no. Not during actual opening hours.
Ed, you've been to the Munich show before, right?
Yes, I have. And
Do you know that liters of brown beer during the daytime are compulsory?
Well, look, I put it to you. I mean, I take it you're going, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
So. On the Thursday, the show is open, as I understand it, from 10 a.m. till 5 or 6, depending on who you talk to. Basically try and kick people out from 5 and actually lock us in at 6. Mm-hmm. I've got 18 hours of press invites for those those times. And, much as I enjoy to kick back and have a giant stein of something, I'm in the interest of being vaguely diligent. I don't know if I'm going to get any chance to stop and look at anything.
Well, it's vague diligence that will be your downfall.
But so, yes.
So for those that have never been, myself and others that are maybe listening, what is Munich? Why is it special? Why do manufacturers take a kit there and do launches? And there's lots of launches happening, even a projector launch this year, which is unusual for an audio show. Yeah. So maybe tell us a little bit about it. I'll go to Simon first. Simon, what's your experiences of the show?
Well, beer, mostly. But these, I think the high end is, it's slightly misleading. Certainly the high end are represented there much more so than a lot of other hi-fi shows, but it's not purely high-end. There's good mainstream and even budget manufacturers there showing whatever it is they choose to show. But it is also one of the few places that you'll get to see 75 grand's worth of monoblock power amplifier or whatever. I mean, in terms of what's happening this year, I don't know about you, Ed, but I've been invited to lots of things just like you, but I have had to sign NDAs about almost all of them. So while I would love to give you the chapter and verse about the different brands and the different products that they're going to be launching, that is something for later in the week, I think, because most people want it to be a nice surprise.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Sorry, that's going to be, things gone very loud. A lot of people are keeping their powder dry, and there's this determination for everything to come out when, once the show's there with live photographs. But yeah, Simon alludes to it. It's one of the very few instances, perhaps now the only instance, where you can see the better part of the audio industry in one place at one time. I mean, there are, you know, in the old days, CES used to have a fairly respectable two-channel contingent, but it pales next to what Munich has achieved. And part of that is because the very first high-end show I ever went to was 2003, and that was the last one held in Frankfurt. And after that, since then, it's been in Munich, and it's been in an exhibition center called the MOC. And the MOC defies easy description. Think of something like the NEC, or whatever we're calling the NEC this week in Birmingham. It's got atriums and big hallways and so on and so forth. But then it has an upper deck of closed spaces. Now, these aren't optimal listening rooms. They're very, very hard surfaces. They're very echoey. But nevertheless, they can be closed off, and you can put a substantial hi-fi system in there. And, you know, they only have to compete vaguely with each other for noise levels. So you've got massive open spaces to put things in, and then smaller spaces in which to do individual exhibitions. And, you know, I've long sort of bemoaned the fact that there's no really equivalent structure anywhere in the UK to do such a thing. And it just became a natural stomping ground to do a hi-fi show. And essentially, because of that, you know, it's had its ups and downs. It's got bigger and smaller over the years. There's been some times where it's gone a complete extra atrium, and there's other times where it hasn't, and so on and so forth. But it's an order of magnitude larger than anything that we've done in the UK. And I'd argue now, I think it's an order of magnitude larger than any other show in the Western Hemisphere. I can't speak for some of the Asian shows. But yeah, it's huge.
No, I was going to say, I think given what you say about CES and CES having kind of abandoned two-channel to a greater extent in favour of automotive and automated hoovers, outside of Asia now, Munich is by far and away the biggest deal for two-channel, I would have thought.
Yeah, and as Simon says as well, it's the only place you can go to where there will be, in the open-air booth, there'll be things that are still sensibly and accommodatingly priced. And then upstairs, there will be at least one item, breaking cover, which will cost, as near as makes no difference, £1 million. Mm-hmm. That level of contrast is always extraordinary. And I think it's proved quite popular because Munich is also relatively easy to get to, both in context of Europe and in terms of direct flights from elsewhere. And it also has the considerable advantage that Munich is quite a nice place to be when the doors close as well. So it's become very much a fixture. And I generally enjoy going every single time, not, you know, time pressures and NDAs notwithstanding, but no, it should yeah. be good.
And just to explain to the listeners why there's NDAs and so on, that's basically because we couldn't write all the news as it's announced. So manufacturers kindly give you the news ahead of time, but we got to sign your life away and basically say you're not going to talk about that till the event happens. But if you were trying to do all of it all at once, you wouldn't be able to do it. So that's why there's NDAs and so on. It's not like people are keeping secrets from you. You're going to get to know it as soon as it's announced.
No, yeah. That's right. You can at least prepare your stories ahead of time. But equally, I don't think manufacturers have been to a lot of trouble, obviously. They don't want some Herbert or other, like Ed and I, spoiling their surprise. They'd much rather present it to you, and then you can inform the world on their behalf.
Yeah, absolutely.
The biggest issue is actually when you get a product ahead of time on an NDA, and then it's essentially, if you have to shoot any photos of anything else that's in, it's just making sure that it doesn't crop up in reflections, or there's a corner of it lurking, or anything which is going to get a horde of extremely angry public relations people calling you instantly and expressing their considerable displeasure at what you've done. So, yeah, it's all fun and games.
So, as you can see, Ed's going out to the show. Ed's going to do our show report for us from Munich. So we're looking forward to that, looking forward to the products coming through and being announced and so on. And Two Channel is it's a big thing these days. It's on the upward trajectory. And as are these shows, as are, I mean, Simon will back me up on this, Ed will back me up as well. The number of invites and press events and companies wanting to show you new product is on an upward as well, which, given that we're in a recession at the minute, it's quite encouraging to see that companies are backing their products and they're releasing new products. And definitely in the two-channel world, that seems to be the main thing. The main thrust is a lot of new product coming. So Munich happening next week. So if you listen to this on the Monday, it's this coming week. So stay tuned to AV Forums for our coverage of that. So let's move to our main subject today. So this year we've been talking about building a hi-fi system from budget all the way to super high-end. I was fortunate enough to pop along to the Peter Tyson at the weekend. They had a hi-fi show in the northeast of England, believe it or not. We had something up north for once. So it was within 20 minutes of me. So I thought, oh, I may as well pop up and have a look and see what's going on. And there's a video will pop up on AV Forums later, probably later this week as well, just showing you what was there. But one system was £500,000. So it was rather nice. When each monoblock was 75 grand, and there was two of them, and that's just the monoblocks. So there you go. Very interesting show, and everything from like 7 grand upwards. So it gave people a chance to walk in off the street, not feel any sales pressure or that like they were wasting anybody's time, because the whole purpose was to let people listen to these systems. And it was fantastic, really good day. The turnover was excellent. There was a steady stream of people through the doors. And I think over the 2 days, they had about 500 attendees, which for a small store, well, I'm saying small store, it's a small unit, but they'll have the whole upstairs with, I think it's 4 demo rooms and a big open space as well. And they got a lot of people through, 500 odd people, is pretty good for the Northeast. So, yeah, you're on this journey, you're buying hi-fi, you're never, ever done. It's the same as AV. You think you're done, but you're never done. It's just till the next upgrade. So you've got your turntable sorted out. We're going to talk amps next month, but we're going to talk speakers, because this is the main area where people tend to get a little bit confused when you're talking about ohms and wattage and how do I drive these and where should I place them, and I've got a bookshelf, or is it a stand mount? Which way can I use it? Which way does it point? Lots of questions, and there's no silly questions as well, which is the whole point of our podcasts and our videos, is there is no silly questions. Ask your questions, and if we can answer them, we certainly will. So bookshelf, stand mount speakers, Ed, different or the same?
The term is interchangeable, but no, technically not. The idea is that, you know, any speaker which does not physically sit some distance off the ground can indeed be placed on a shelf or suitable piece of furniture as a sort of extrusion. The catch is, and we'll cover bass ports and stuff in just a moment, some speakers are physically designed for the task of being on furniture and in enclosed spaces, and they will respond positively to this. Other speakers can be placed on furniture and in enclosed spaces, but they don't necessarily take kindly to you doing so. So manufacturers are just as bad as journalists at this. And I don't want to sound defensive, but there are many times when a manufacturer will describe their product as a bookshelf loudspeaker, and placing it on a bookshelf is not going to get anything out of it that's worth listening to. But if you are specifically looking to use furniture, there are designs, and certain companies have a particular knack at this. So, you know, it's something to consider separately. But stand mount is in some ways a more accurate description, because any speaker of those dimensions will work happily on a stand, whereas only some of them will work happily on a bookshelf.
And I think that's an important thing to get straight away, is where to position the speaker. Some, like Ed says, are designed to be up against the surface and use boundary gain and so on. Others like a bit of breathing space. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing to consider. Consider your room. It's. I know we sound like broken records here, but it is the most important aspect of any system, is the room. So we've already discussed that in depth, but just keep that in mind. Next thing, Simon, is placement. So now we know we don't need... well, where we should be placing these speakers. What is the correct placement? Do we use toe-in these days or not? Or, you know, what is toe-in for people?
Toe-in is where you angle the speaker, the face of the speaker with the drivers, where the drivers face out from, to tow them in is to point them inward slightly so that they form a line towards the position where you're listening. I think it's safe to say, and Ed will contradict me if I'm wrong, but I think it's safe to say the majority of manufacturers design their speakers in order for a little toe-in to be appropriate. There are outliers. Dali, for instance, prefer the term firing squad, I think, which is where everything just faces straight forward, no matter where in the room it is. It just
kudos
comes straight out. Yes, yeah, they are, aren't they? But the majority of brands, I think, design their speakers to be towed in a little bit towards your seated position. So if you were to sort of draw a line from the center of the front of the speaker, it would cross, the two lines would cross just in front of where you're sitting.
Yes, I would second that. It does vary, and obviously, you know, as we'll cover, your distance to them and things like that will vary as well. But yeah, I would say, in terms of going back to the very dim and distant past where I was actually working for a speaker manufacturer, toe-in was designed in from the outset of what they were designed to do. They weren't designed to point straight forward, even if you were a long, long way away from them. There were the principle of how they radiated sound worked on the principle of those points of sound intersecting at some point.
Excellent. So we know how far they need to be away from the wall. We know what toe-in is. So I guess, and again, we're going through 101 here. Feel free to skip to the next chapter if we're, you know, telling you how to suck eggs here, but we want to try and cover absolutely everything. So the next thing is obviously room size and how far away we're going to be sitting from the speakers and where our listening position is. So in terms of other rules that people should be following when it comes to that, Ed?
There are, but this is a real area of variance, and the reason for that is twofold. The first is that some surprisingly large speakers work in surprisingly small spaces from certain manufacturers. There are different reasons for that. There's no hard and fast rule on that. The other, of course, is that in 2024, a number of the products that you might be connecting it to are perfectly capable of EQing their responses to handle larger speakers in smaller spaces. As a general rule of thumb, what you're looking for is a speaker that doesn't overdrive the room. Now, when we say that, we just basically mean once you've got a bit of you know, headroom behind it, is the effect, you know, entirely overbearing? Is it making the room resonate? Is it playing about with certain, you know, specific frequency points and so on and so forth? As well as the size of the room, you've got to think about the type of your room. Does it have a weird little alcove at one corner where sound can disappear off and do all sorts of unpleasant things? Are you on a suspended floor? What are your walls made out of? I mean, as by example, my listening space, by the standards of, you know, certainly what American speaker companies consider to be a reasonable room, is nowhere near. But it has a solid floor and very solid walls. And once it's got some furniture and a fat bloke in it, it's actually, generally speaking, fairly well behaved. You can have a much larger room with a suspended floor, and you will need to look at a loudspeaker that doesn't overexcite that, what is essentially a giant cavity, which it can turn into a sort of large passive subwoofer. So I know that we're trying to do this as a sort of basic 101, but basically this is where, going back to a recurring theme of these podcasts, if you go to a proper dealer and explain what size your room is and what shape it's made out of, you may find some surprising answers about the size of the loudspeaker that will actually fit in that space. So really, 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 this is an occasion where the experience of a decent retailer is going to save you a lot of time and heartache.
And again, just like the AV world, the hi-fi world, anything where you're using audio within a room, Simon, you need to be thinking about acoustics, as Ed touched on there, and first reflection points and dispersion and absorption and so on. So how seriously should people consider this? Or are there some basic rules that they can follow that maybe improve the performance of the system within a room that's quite easy to attain?
Well, I suppose a lot of it comes down to how willing your individual is to devote this particular room to speakers and to an audio system, because quite a lot of time other things have got to happen in this room, as well as you listening to your system, and which precludes the idea of putting bass traps or any sort of overt room treatment in that respect. And so it's a question really of what you have to do in your room, first of all, to accommodate your system. And then once you have established the space in your room, which you are prepared to give over to your system, then there are things that you can do to sort of maximize its performance. And you're talking about boundaries, you're talking about hard surfaces and glazing and what have you, and the way that speakers will respond to that sort of thing. And the sort of space within the room, the free space that the speakers you prefer are going to demand.
And of course,
but as Ed said, you know, a decent dealer will help you with that. But really, you need to know what as regards your room, and you need to know how far you're prepared to go in order to accommodate this. If you're fortunate, you've got a space that is purely for listening. But I don't think the majority of people have that.
No. And again, it's one of these things that I think sometimes I'll point fingers at myself, that we tend to forget this when we live in this world and we deal with this all the time, that, you know, people can't ideally place the speakers where they should ideally be placed, or the TV where it should be, and so on. So, you know, taking those compromises on board and then thinking about the issue and how to solve it. And Ed, the whole industry has woken up to this fact that the room is important when it comes to sound. And you can buy some really quite funky absorption materials now that actually look like artwork, or really nice, and something that you'd want to hang on the wall.
Basically, it's no longer a question that you need to cover the ceiling in egg boxes. Which, I mean, unless you want to cover the ceiling in egg boxes, that is obviously your prerogative. But yes, I mean, there's a lot to be said for just putting a decent amount of furnishings in there. I mean, I'm always hesitant to start talking about rugs, because someone inevitably just parrots, "Oh, it really ties the room together," and a sort of Big Lebowski sort of thing. But one of the reasons why I have a rug in my room, listening room, is that it's a laminate floor, and without it, things get a little bit hard and a little bit echoey. But the rug essentially it intersects the first reflection point and just essentially helps calm the room down. If you have significant sofas, they will make a difference as well. And I mean, you don't have to immediately go down the path of dedicated room treatment items. Just, you know, this current trend towards grey minimalist spaces, and I'm not talking about grey in a dull sense, we just seem to be weirdly obsessed with grey at the moment. That can be quite a harsh space to get going, but the moment you've actually put some clutter in, you'll be amazed at how much things calm down.
Yeah, and Simon, there's tricks that can be used, like bookshelves and ornaments and so on, just to create a bit of dispersion, a bit of diffusion to the sound as well, which helps.
No, that's right. You can, but I mean, you come back to the point about actually having a room that is multi-purpose, because you will have a rug, you will have some soft furnishings, you will probably have curtains. And all of these will contribute, and exciting the room is the last thing that we want, right? And so if the room can be kept nice and calm and nice and neutral, the way that you would generally go about decorating can help that. And if it is still a little bit hard and it is a little bit reflective, and you can tell that that is the case from the sound of your voice in there, quite honestly, then bookshelves with books on them are great. Soft furnishings are great.
I mean, records
are good too. I mean, opinion in this house is divided as to whether records are decorative or not. but nevertheless, there are a lot of them here, and they do help.
Yeah.
So excellent. So we've covered most of the basics here, but the basic we're missing here, and we're talking about bookshelf and stand mounted speakers, is what height should they be in terms of your listening position, Simon?
Well, I mean, the classic rule of thumb is that the tweeter area of your loudspeaker, and that's almost certain to be the top driver, should be more or less level with your eyes and ears when you're in your seated position where you're going to be doing your listening from. And the majority of speaker stands are designed to bring your average stand mounting speaker up to that kind of height that your average person will be when they're sitting in your average chair. Mm. I mean, there's a lot of assumptions being made here, obviously, but furniture is the size of furniture. Stand mounting speakers tend to be the size of stand mounting speakers. And so when you're sitting down to listen, they really ought to be at head height.
It's worth pointing out as well that if a manufacturer is hell bent on that not being the case, the onus is on them to generally explain that on both their website and their material.
And to provide stance. Yeah.
Yes, this is also true. There are a couple of notable exceptions to what Simon's explained, but they are notable exceptions, and they do make a point of explaining that they are notable exceptions and why they've done it that way. You cannot go too far wrong if the tweeter is vaguely akin to where your ear is going to be.
And another terminology that people may pick up on that's been discussed on forums and so on when it comes to speaker placement and so on is near field and far field. Ed, do you want to cover that one and what that basically means?
Yes. I mean, once again, for anyone who's listening to this outside of Europe, in North America especially, everything, as far as they're concerned, everything we do in Europe is near field. For the most part, just a simple statement of how our houses are designed. But near field refers to being relatively close to loudspeakers. There is no magic number under which it counts as near field, and then above that is not. But the original term was when you were doing things like working at a mixing desk and you had speakers directly in front of you, and you were basically using them like a giant open-backed pair of headphones. In most spaces, what you're sitting and listening to doesn't count as that level of near field. But nevertheless, if you are within 2 meters or so of the loudspeaker, many speaker manufacturers consider sub 2 meters to be near field. So again, it will depend slightly on whose speakers you've purchased, but absolute near field listening means that you are right up against them. But you know, in some cases, any point where you are in the room would count as near field as far as the company building the speaker is concerned. So do check. But you know, actual far field listening, you are going to be several meters away from the loudspeakers, able to see both of them without twisting your head, and you know, a realistic distance away from them, you know, 4 to 5 meters would be sort of classic on that.
Yeah, we certainly want to be further from them than they are from each other.
Yes.
I mean, that's you can take that actually in terms of whether you're listening near field or far field. Wherever you decide your speakers need to be, whatever that distance is between them, you need to be further away than that.
That's fair.
Yeah, no, that's a good way of looking at it, Simon. Excellent. Right, so we've positioned them, we've got them all set up, we're sat down, and then we suddenly think, have I got enough power to drive these speakers? Or I am confused as to what an ohm is and how an amplifier works and so on. And my amplifier only does 60 watts. Is it enough to drive these speakers? Because the speakers say 130 watts. Ed, do you want to take the first stab at trying to explain this one? Because it is the main...
Not without getting on my hobby horse, probably.
Put 10 minutes aside.
Oh, mate. A recurring theme that I see both on AV forums and elsewhere is people seemingly thinking that they need truly biblical amounts of amplifier power to do standard listening in a UK space. And you really, really, really don't. Speakers will list either the maximum amount of sustained power that they can withstand before bits of them start to fall off, or they will give an ideal operating envelope of power, so a minimum and a maximum figure. Or some smaller companies will just do vibes and say, look, just see what you think and how it goes. This is then combined with their sensitivity and their impedance measurements. So in a given review, myself or Simon will quote a sensitivity figure, which is the amount of decibels that a speaker will give when 1 watt RMS of pink noise is applied to it and then measured at a distance of 1 meter, I believe.
That's right.
And the impedance then is measured in ohms and represents the amount of resistance that the speaker puts up whilst it's doing that. So generally speaking, the higher both numbers are, the easier the speaker is to drive. So you end up with sometimes slightly opaque measurement sets. The Acoustic Energy Corinium review that's on the site, that's a 92 dB watt sensitive loudspeaker. So you stick one watt of pink noise in, you get 92 decibels out, which is extremely efficient, except that this is something that requires the resistance it presents at that point is 4 ohms. So Yes, it's sensitive up to a point, but there is a requirement for current delivery from the amplifier, which rather rather sort of goes against that. Now, so directly after that, Boas and Wilkins 702S3 signature, that's come through. Sensitivity figure is nowhere near as high, but its minimum impedance figure is actually, it has a fractionally moment in its point where it's less sensitive than the Carinium, but for the most part, it actually has a higher impedance. So in realistic terms, the amount of power it needs doesn't change very much. If you wanted a basic rule of thumb, in most UK spaces, 30 to 40 watts underpinned by decent electrical delivery will be more than sufficient to drive almost anything, certainly at the affordable end of things and probably all the way up till the low four figure points. There are obviously exceptions, but again, those manufacturers will probably make it known that they have tremendously insensitive loudspeakers. You need an arc welder to drive them. So you do not need a telephone number power output. I mean, it won't hurt. And it is worth pointing out that if you are driving a pair of loudspeakers hard on an amplifier with not a lot of power, the distortion that amplifier creates is going to cause the speaker more grief than putting too many clean, undistorted watts through it. So there is a happy operating point, but you do not need several hundred watts for a UK lounge.
Anything to add to that, Simon?
No, I can't argue with any of that. I think it is possible to get to get too hung up on this. And some manufacturers are kind of guilty of propagating this, because they will choose very favorable conditions in which to measure their power output of their of their electronics. And so suddenly this an amplifier that you know can serve up 50 watts comfortably can be rated at 600 watts if you want. And that's a much more exciting number, but it doesn't really have any relevance to what it is you're trying to do. And unless, as Ed says, unless your speaker's hugely insensitive or extremely demanding of electrical current, then you shouldn't really have any issues in any kind of real world environment. I think it's kind of, I always think this about the speedometer in your car, or my car, or your car. I mean, God forbid I should drive my car at 160 miles an hour, right? But that's where the speedometer is marked up to. But I presume that means that when I'm driving at 70 miles an hour and no faster, then everything is nicely unstressed and everything's operating within parameters whereby it could continue at that sort of speed indefinitely. And I think that's not dissimilar to what we're looking for in a relationship between an amplifier and a loudspeaker. But I think ultimately what Ed said is, I'm paraphrasing, Ed, you'll forgive me, but you'll have to go some to get this badly wrong.
Yes.
Relationship between the electrical part and the passive loudspeaker that the electronics are driving. That's difficult to balls up, really.
Okay, good. Right, so we've got all the basics done. Now let's look at what are the advantages and disadvantages of going for a bookshelf or stand mount speaker over, let's say, the other main contender, which is a floor standard speaker. And we're going to get into floor standards a little bit further down the line. But Ed, what are the potential advantages and disadvantages, first of all, of our bookshelf and stand mount speakers?
Again, I don't want to sound like I've got, you know, massive personal hobby horses here. In most UK lounges, a stand mount loudspeaker will dial into that space significantly better than a number of floor standards. It's just the nature, physics doesn't take a day off. It doesn't fail. Most of us do not have enormous amounts of space. And for the most part, a well-designed stand mount speaker can be exploited more readily and be driven harder and more satisfactorily in most of the spaces that we tend to call homes than floor standers. Now, this is my personal preference. Equally, I've just been spending a fair amount of time around large floor standers, and I will say that there is a certain, beyond bass extension, there is a certain effortless level of scale and heft, and that remains the case at lower listening levels that you do kind of get used to. There's no getting around that. So you need to decide on your styles of music. You need to decide how much room you have and so on and so forth. My preference is always stand mounts. Just has been now for over 20 years. But I have that on the balance of the fact that I don't live in particularly large spaces, and I always find them easier to dial in. Aesthetically, I would argue that probably floor standers become furniture rather more easily, but I don't think either of them are necessarily unattractive. So if you do have a bit more room, floor standers tend to have both a higher ultimate, you know, sound pressure level delivery, and they will, generally speaking, produce more bass whilst they do so. Although, as with everything, there's always exceptions and caveats to that. But unless you've got at least one wall of 4 meters, and ideally more, I generally stay with stand mounts if you can stomach the aesthetic. And then after that, start looking at larger things. Going back to what we said earlier, you can use Dirac and EQ and things like that to start getting a larger speaker to behave in a smaller space. But ultimately, you are applying the audio equivalent of traction control to get the damn thing to dial in. So if you're not going to be doing that, you're going to be doing things by straight straight amplification, you'll, generally speaking, in a smaller space, get better results from a stand mount loudspeaker. And that's what I would steer people towards, especially as manufacturers have got over their hang-ups that stand mounts can't exceed a certain price. And there are now very respectable stand mount speaker options all the way up to £20,000 and beyond.
Any you want to add to that, Simon?
I wish there was, Phil, but to be honest, that is just perfect sense. It's not every day I say that to him, it's all equally worth observing, I think, that when you're talking about smaller rooms, and we've already discussed how you might want to treat your room or how you have to make accommodations in your room, the accommodations for stand mounting speakers are less because the sound pressure level they're producing, because the frequency range extension that they're capable of is not so great as your average floor standard, then they are less likely to set the room off. Mm. It's always every part of the frequency range can be problematic, but it's always bass that's a problem.
Right? Yes.
And so if your extension is only down to 50 hertz, and it's nice and tightly controlled, and you're on proper stands, and everything's nicely isolated, and it's all coming forwards instead of going downwards, then you are much less likely to have issues in the room than if you've got a stand mounter that can go down to 30 hertz and is distributing this stuff down at knee level as well.
Yeah.
So I guess that leads on to, and I guess from the AV world, it seems to be the done thing. You know, you look at sub-sat systems. So when you're looking at stand mount or bookshelf speakers and you want that extension, what are the general rules on using a subwoofer in a hi-fi system? Because I know there's varying opinions on this, and I'm going to go to Simon first because he's making the faces here. So Simon.
This is just my face. as I understand it, Phil, and I always defer to you with AV stuff, but there's a great deal of requirement for simple presence. In an AV system, which is not quite the same, I don't think, as in a two channel set or for music. With music, you're not the bass. You know, you want bass extension, but you need control and maneuverability and variation and dynamism and just the sort of straight edged stop start of the attack and the decay, which isn't automatically the case, I don't think, with AV systems. And of course, if you're using a separate subwoofer to the loudspeakers, then you've got issues with tonality and a match there. So getting a crossover between the speakers and the subwoofer is more critical than it is, again, speaking very generally, than it is with AV systems. So I think if you were talking about a subwoofer to complement a pair of stand mounting or bookshelf speakers, then something small and responsive and deft is what's required, rather than something that is simply going to punch you.
I don't disagree with that. It's less important to be able to recreate the brown noise as it is to be able to basically move at the same speed as the speaker that it is running to, because effectively it's as much the fact that unless you are listening to multi-channel music, which is a slightly different kettle of fish, there's no dedicated LFE channel. Obviously, with two channel, you are simply hiving off a set of frequencies below a point that you've set to be handled by the subwoofer, and all manner of things can be going on in that. And it places different requirements over and above some of the viscerally powerful subwoofers that we look at on AVF, which are designed to receive an LFE channel, and they will do absolute justice to that LFE channel. That's what they are designed to do. Often, actually, it's been donkey season since I've reviewed a sub for the site, but there is always the, there's generally speaking, someone brings it, it's, you know, subwoofers are subwoofers, and there's no such thing as a musical subwoofer. It's not necessarily the case of it being a musical subwoofer, but there are differing requirements for sub bass, and certain manufacturers pay different attentions to different requirements, and that is going to have a result in what that subwoofer does in those spaces. You can't legitimately point to, I suppose, two different ends of things. So you look at the larger members of the SVS family, which are tremendous AV devices, and then you look at something like Eclipse, who build very, very specialist subwoofers to partner their single driver things. And the two, the design requirements, they are both subwoofers, and they both have an amplifier and at least one large driver. That's where the similarities end. In every other regard, they are constructed in a different way, they are built in a different way, they're designed to be used in a different way. And the results that you get in room are radically different. I think that this industry does have a hang-up about adding subwoofers to two-channel, because on occasions we've all heard it being done extremely badly, but it can be done exceptionally well, and you can get excellent results from it. So don't be afraid to go against received wisdom and have a tinker. But Simon is exactly right. You're not looking for something which has a single figure lower extent figure extension. That is far less important than the ability to keep up with the speakers to which it is operating in partnership with.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Right. Time to get to the contentious area where I know most of the comments are going to come from. Speaker cable. Right. We have to cover this one because it is part of a system, and the stands, which also I remember back to Ed's Bowers & Wilkins 805 signature review, where the stands were 10% of the actual cost of the speaker, and people were not happy with that, Ed. But no. When I first got into this hobby a long, long time ago, it was always a factor that when you were talking about your budget for a speaker or a system or whatever, you should always put at least 10% aside for things like stands, or 10% aside for well-made speaker cables or interconnects. Has it changed, or is that still a general rule that people should maybe consider?
It certainly hasn't changed for stands. It's mechanical engineering. And also the materials which they're made out of, metal and other things like that, the cost of that gone bananas. So even a relatively prosaic pair of decent stands are not inconsequentially expensive. And I don't want to go on about bespoke stands, because it's clearly an area where some people ascribe zero value to. But I do think that there are very decent reasons for choosing a stand designed by the manufacturer to work with that speaker. But nevertheless, even if you have no interest in that, to buy a decent, solid, well-made, well-finished stand is going to cost you in 2024, I'm tempted to say, a bare minimum of about £200 for something that doesn't look like it was made out of, you know, made on Scrap Heap Challenge. I mean, to go here, this is where the angry people turn up.
I know.
Do it.
I know.
Do it.
Yeah.
All right. Do it. Otherwise, you're just denying the importance of cables.
Well, okay.
This information, all of this critical, complicated, significant information has got to be moved from point A to point B somehow.
Yes. Mm. And a decent cross-sectional weight of a decently conductive metal is not going to do you any harm in the pursuit of that. I would also say that even if you aren't a reviewer who changes their loudspeakers every week to 10 days, there's a lot to be said for having dedicated terminations fitted to your speaker cable by professionals, because it makes the business of connecting them up a great deal simpler. Those connections don't go manky in oxygen over the years that they are connected, and there is almost no danger of those cables then shorting and causing damage to your electronics. Even before we get to any notional arguments over performance, it's just neat and tidy for them to terminate in a connection which you slot into place, rather than frenziedly twist and screw into place with fronds of copper going all over the place whilst you do so. So These things do not need to cost a fortune. All of the major speaker manufacturers will produce you a neat set of terminated cables for not, well, for a night in the pub, I think, if we wanted to probably put it in a manner of context that I think is worth the effort. You can spend a lot more. And if you wish to pursue this, most dealers will let you do the testing on a sale or return basis. So you can essentially decide that it is of no use, get them in, convince yourself it's of no use, and send them home again. But you can say with great smugness on the internet that you did try. So see where it goes from there.
I think what people confuse digital with analog, they also confuse a competent speaker cable with some of the snake oil that is out there, because this industry does have that. And there are people who will sell you speaker cable at £2,000 a meter.
Yeah.
And are you going to hear any discernible difference between that and something that costs 50 quid? This is, I think, where things get a little bit heated and a little bit over the top. In terms of just buying a system, and it's what I say with any other bit of kit, is just put a decent part of your budget aside and build and buy something that's been built well. Like Ed says, properly terminated, properly put together. It's going to last you a few years and so on. And I don't know what Simon wants to say, but Simon, any add to that?
Well, I'm sure. No, you talk perfect sense. It's possible to get carried away with this as surely as anywhere else in your system, of course. And everything has to be proportionate, and the law of diminishing returns is at work. And it will come a point where the electronics and the speakers that you wish to connect together are not going to perform any better or with any discernible improvements once you reach a certain level of connection. But equally, it's possible to hamstring both of these items by not doing this properly. And it's possible to not hear what these pieces of equipment are capable of if you don't join them together, at least sympathetically.
Mm-hmm. It's also just one other thing. Cable manufacturers would love you to upgrade. It's obviously part of their business model, but some of the other part of the business model is that it's incredibly long lived, and often the warranties that they offer are outstanding. I've got one of the sets of speaker cable in regular use in testing is a pair of terminated AudioQuest CV6 runs, which I received when Marantz, who was distributing Morden Short at the time, also was distributing AudioQuest, and the call went out in the office, would anyone like to order some speaker cable for their system? Yeah, why not? Free cable. Those runs of cable are 21 years old, and they are exactly the same as the day that they were unpacked. I mean, I've lost the boxes, but other than that, they are exactly the same as they were 21 years ago. There's nothing else in the system, with the partial exception of one turntable, which is anything like it, you know, which has been around for the same amount of time, and that's required a damn sight more maintenance than the speaker cables ever have. If you do buy something which is well finished and well terminated, the chances are, if you have no further interest in ever changing it, you won't need to. It's effectively immortal, especially if it's got proper terminations on it. So there is something to be said for just accepting your initial cost as being a one-time thing, because unless you suddenly need them to be drastically longer, they probably aren't going to wear out ever.
And this brings us to the final point here, I think, just to wrap everything up neatly at the end. And that is what Ed was touching on just at the end there, that making the right choices early on, or doing some good research, looking at what your choices are and so on, and then making the purchase based on what you want. So again, when you're demoing stuff, don't listen to demo tracks if you don't listen to demo tracks at home. Don't listen to jazz unless you listen to jazz at home. Don't listen to heavy rock unless you listen to heavy rock at home. Go and listen to what you want to listen to on whatever it is that you're considering buying, because at the end of the day, you have to like it.
I promise you, the dealer has heard worse. They've always heard worse.
Yes, they've always heard worse.
And don't be scared, you know, to take your stuff along and listen to it and enjoy it, because at the end of the day, that's what's going to happen. But if you make good choices now, if you do your research, if you take on as much information as you can, Simon, you can buy a system that's going to last you a lifetime.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. If you've got the sort of moral fiber that stops you hankering after something different, then you can certainly. Because if you find a sympathetic dealer, and there's plenty of them, and you find a system that you enjoy the sound of, then frankly, there's no disputing that. It's not for you or Ed or me to tell you that you're wrong. If this is the system that sounds right to you, then this is your system. And as I say, and if you, unless you're talking about big technological advances, then there's absolutely no reason that shouldn't last you a long time, as long as you don't overdrive it.
The other thing is, there is no more subjective piece of equipment, I'd argue, over and above anything else. So, I mean, if you wanted a neat case in point, because it's both of us on this podcast, both Simon and I have reviewed the Mission 700. You, when it boils down to it, think that it has a number of quite egregious limitations and can be provoked quite easily, whereas I think it's absolutely brilliant. Now, effectively, both of those arguments, you know, you can come listen to them in our respective spaces, and probably both, and you know, with the equipment that we test with, and you'll get a handle on why we both hold those positions. There is no more subjective piece of equipment that you will choose to buy, and this applies actually to multi-channel as well. I mean, even when you've EQ'd the knackers off something, it will still exhibit traits and characteristics which are specific to the materials involved and the manner in which it's been designed, more than any other set of equipment that crosses paths on AV forums. You can read our comments, and generally speaking, we'll tell you as much useful stuff as we can, especially about how it dials into spaces, because most of that is applicable. But when it comes down to it, the final manner in how it performs is going to be, even when you've got two entirely correct and well-engineered approaches. I mean, a classic example in the at the moment, there's a pair of Bowers and Wilkins here. Off to one side of mine's a pair of Focals. Both of those speakers are engineered by people who have many degrees. They have access to material science, which is incredibly sophisticated, but they are so different to listen to, and one of them is always going to appeal to you more than the other one is. So there's no such thing as a one size fits all correct choice on this. You must go, if you choose to buy an extremely expensive pair of loudspeakers sight unseen, I do slightly question your sanity, because the results will be wholly unexpected a lot of the time. So please be careful, and please listen to something, because there's many different ways to crack this particular.
And I think that's the most important point. Before I got into this and doing this as a living, I made sure I had a number of dealers who I was on good terms with, who I'd bought equipment from, who I'd borrowed equipment from, and also used their demo facilities. And one afternoon, I thought I knew what I wanted. I'd read What Hi-Fi and some other publications, and we're going back to the early 90s here. And I thought, yeah, I know what I want. I want these KEF Qs. And I went and demoed them and hated them. I did not like the sound at all. And I spent the afternoon going through different iterations of speakers that were very similar, until I found something that I liked, and that was a Bowers & Wilkins 600 at the time. And I preferred that to the Q version KEV. And again, that was nothing more than personal taste at the end of the day, and a huge dose of subject, but I enjoyed that. And that's what it's
about. Exactly. I mean, it's, as I said, you can't, there's no one's able to tell you you're wrong, right? One person's lively and exciting is another person's, it's been like being shouted at.
Yes.
And so you will, you know, the sound that you prefer will reveal itself to you quite easily. You can, you know, Ed and I can guide you. You, Phil, you can guide us all. But ultimately, you have to go and listen. Even if all you've used Ed and Ed's opinions for is to compile a shortlist.
Yeah.
And maybe there'll be nothing on that shortlist that you like, in which case you can discount Ed's opinions forever.
And that's what we always say. You should never go out and buy on the end of a review. Never read a review and then go.
No, do your research,
but go and see the product and witness it and experience it yourself and so on. Mm-hmm. So I guess we've just talked for an hour, and all we're saying is go and listen.
Yes.
Well, yes, but you
can, yes. If I'd known this was all we were going to say, that I could have put the kettle on.
We covered certain things of minor worth, this is the one area where your dealer will be your friend.
Yeah.
And save you probably an enormous amount of time and hurt.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
And I suppose the other thing, of course, is that when you go and see them, certain finishes which look astonishing in photographs can be utterly disappointing, and other speakers which can be very, very frumpy in photographs are surprisingly beautiful when you see them for real.
It's really funny you say that, because when I was at Peter Tyson's, I had a look at the... so they had the 801 D4 signatures in the blue finish.
Yeah.
And they also had the 705 S3 signatures in the same blue.
Yeah.
They looked so different. And the reason they look so different is the stand mount speaker was a lot smaller, so there was less light hitting it, so you were getting less of the blue back, whereas the 800, the nice big 800, was capturing more light.
And the curve gives you a huge amount of radius light back.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, go see it, because they do look completely different. Right, so I think we've covered everything we need to cover in this podcast. So that's it for this week. My thanks to Simon. It's great to see you on the podcast. Hopefully you'll be along again for some more in the future, so thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
And of course, thanks to Ed as well. And the next podcast, the next episode, is the TV Display and Calibration Edition. It's up on Monday, the 13th of May. Like I say, go to AV Forums podcast channel and subscribe there, and you'll never miss one. We're also on all of the major audio podcast providers. So just search AV Forums and you'll find us there. Like I say, every Monday, there is a new podcast, usually around about 7 p.m. And check all of that out. I can usually do the old, like, click, subscribe, the cliched stuff. Go do it. And you can also buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/AV Forums. I'm Phil Hinton. Thank you very much for watching and listening, and we'll see you the next time. Goodbye.